This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to have with me Dr. Fumilayo Showers to tell us about her honestly quite fascinating book, because it takes as a starting point the fact that the US population is aging and healthcare needs therefore are becoming more complex. There's higher demand for paid care workers in all sorts of settings. And who is actually doing that labor? This book details how immigrants are often a big part of the labor pool meeting this need. And the book, published by Rutgers University Press, titled Migrants Who Care, West Africans Working and Building Lives in U.S. Healthcare, takes us into these stories. It's an ethnographic deep dive into groups of English-speaking West African immigrants who have become really quite central to U.S. healthcare systems, especially if we're thinking about long-term and elder care, which is obviously a really important part of how the U.S. healthcare system works, but maybe not one we've looked at from this angle. So, Fumilayo, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you for having me, Miranda.
I'm very pleased to have you. Could you start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. My name is Fumilayo Showers, and I am an assistant professor of sociology and Africana studies at the University of Connecticut, USA. I am originally from Sierra Leone, West Africa, and I moved to the U.S. at the age of 18 to live with my aunt, who had migrated many years prior. You know, I feel, therefore, that migration has always, almost always, been a part of my personal biography. And my move to the U.S. was actually not the first major international move I had made. My experience with migration began when I was 14 years old, when I left my country, Sierra Leone, due to civil unrest and conflict. I moved to the Gambia, West Africa, prompted by my parents' decision to secure a future of safety for their children. And I completed high school there, and I came to the U.S. shortly thereafter as a college student. It was at that time that I began to notice other members of my Sierra Leonean immigrant networks, my aunt's friends and acquaintances, my friends from high school, who also migrated in their teens or later, were working as nursing assistants, home health aides, nurses, etc. In the case of my friends, most of them I knew had never expressed an interest in the health industry or health professions, but nevertheless, they had become incorporated into this labor force when they migrated to the United States. So it was really these personal connections that prompted my interest. And it was not until graduate school that I began to develop an intellectual interest in issues of migration, race, gender, labor, healthcare. Or better yet, I should say, it was graduate school that gave me the language to transform transform my personal background and casual observations into an intellectual enterprise. And as it turns out, the phenomenon that I was observing among my family and friends was illustrative of broader social and economic factors, the increasing aging of the American population, the need for professional caregivers in home and institutional settings, and an industry that had sprung up in the markets for care of elderly adults, etc. And that's really what became the subject of my book, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, no, that trajectory very much makes sense, having read the book myself. I want to, in fact, dive into what you were speaking of just there, of the different factors that shape people going into these practices. As one of the factors, you detail in the book different US government policies. Can you talk about how different policies have shaped who was able to come to the US, what sort of work they ended up being able to do once they got there? How does this help us understand this trajectory that you were seeing?
Yeah, certainly. And I think U.S. immigration policy in particular played an instrumental role in shaping these trajectories, especially in terms of how the participants in this qualitative research study were able to settle and navigate the work environment after they migrated. And the immigration policies allowed them to come to the U.S. And I'll talk about the migration policies in a little while. But just in terms of motivations for why people left, I found that the motivations were varied and nuanced, right? Oftentimes, they were motivated by multiple factors rather than a single one. The most common reason why the people left their homes in West Africa, and I'm focusing on five nations really in this book, Nigeria, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Cameroon. And these are English speakers from those countries. And the most common reason why they left was quite simply that they were compelled to or forced to. The people, especially from Sierra Leone and Liberia, were compelled by the political climates in their home countries, really in the 90s, wars, political conflict. And so that prompted the migrations in Ghana and Nigeria for also coup d'etats, etc., and other political instability. Prompted the migration. But others stated that they had left their countries simply because of economic troubles. The folks who had left in the late 80s and early 90s, this was a time really across the board in these nations where there was a lot of political and economic turmoil, largely because of the failures of macroeconomic policies, the impact of like the International Monetary Fund, led structural adjustment policies that devastated the economies. And this is happening not just in West Africa, but elsewhere in the developing world, as other scholars have written about. So many of these folks were middle-class professionals, teachers, engineers, etc., but they left because of their deteriorating economic situations. And others simply said that they wanted to come to the United States to seek better opportunities, what they thought would be better educational opportunities for themselves and their children. And a small minority talked about being motivated to migrate because they were in search of adventure. But I think what is most important is that oftentimes the motivations were mixed. There was not just a single thing, right? So for instance, even the people who were ultimately able to arrive as refugees or who sought political asylum because of the political conflicts also talked about economic situations. And, you know, and so, and as other scholars have pointed out, right, so the sort of categories that we have in mind about immigration, you know, refugees versus economic migrants, do not always hold true in reality. And this immigrant group really showcased that there were a multiplicity of factors that motivated folks to leave. And now to actually actualize their journeys, right, the immigration policies of the U.S. helped. Most of the folks arrived because of refugee provisions in immigration law and family reunification provisions. These are just provisions in immigration law that allows for one to settle if they already have family members present in the United States. And this was a provision in the landmark 1965 Immigration Act. And so many of the folks came here because they had parents usually who had migrated before, or spouses who had been in the United States. And then also what was fascinating about this group in terms of immigration policy is that some had arrived and settled in the United States because of diversity provisions in immigration law. In the 1990 Immigration Act, there was provisions for a diversity visa lottery, or the DV lottery, as it has become commonly known. And this is a lottery system for nations that historically have been underrepresented in terms of immigration in the United States. And a number of these folks sort of qualified for that provision and entered the lottery in their home countries and literally won the right to live and work in the United States. And so the refugee, family reunification, and diversity visa lotteries were the main channels through which they came. Others came on temporary visa categories as students and then regularized and made their stay more permanent after they had stayed in the United States for a while. And so here, U.S. immigration policy is really a sight to look at in terms of the possibility of creating this labor pool who were able to enter the U.S. labor market, right, in health careers, right, in this sort of regularized and highly bureaucratic segments of the labor force, and see in comparison, right, to sort of other immigrants who work, say, in agriculture as informal farm laborers or in other informal sectors of the economy. So their access to sort of legalized pathways in this way enabled this group to settle and make the kinds of gains that I ultimately talk about in the book.
Thank you for taking us through the mixture of reasons and the ways in which the policies impact what work can be done. I think that already has added a lot of helpful nuance often to political debates that don't necessarily take into account those sorts of details. If we sort of move on in the journey, thinking about why leaving, why going to the US, what are the different ways in which that is possible to happen? How then do the West African immigrants that you spoke with come to enter specifically care work in the healthcare industry? And were there differences in terms of how people came into the industry based off of things like class or age?
Oh, great question. Now, the first thing I will say is that not one single person I met migrated with the intention to become a healthcare worker or professional. They all became health professionals after migration. And in fact, the book sort of traces these transformations. There were a small minority who, in the sample, who were professional nurses, but they came into the United States not through their work as nurses. As I had said previously, some came as diversity visa lottery winners, or they accompanied their spouses, etc. So these nurses often had to retrain or gain further credentials to be able to work as nurses in the United States. So, but in terms of their pathways and trajectories into care work, I divided the care workers I met in the study roughly into three groups. The first were the people who had migrated as children or in their preteens, and they had often come to join parents who had migrated earlier. And then there were the people who had migrated as young adults. This group often had migrated to attend college in the United States or university in the United States. And they along with the ones who had migrated as children, the so-called 1.5 generation in immigration speak, they had done most of their schooling in the U.S. or their college educations in the U.S. and often had other goals for themselves, other life goals, right? Just like, you know, the average young adult, you know, they had plans to go to graduate school or to become lawyers or engineers. And oftentimes they start their trajectory into care work was informed by what I call life interruption. So something happened in the course of their lives. And for example, one person I met, whom I call Nelson in the book, he came from a prominent family, political family in Sierra Leone. His dad was like a very influential politician. And he came to the United States as to attend university. And he had actually, Nelson had attended one of the most prestigious public universities in the United States. He graduated with a degree in political science and was, you know, his plans were to go on to do a PhD in history and to enter academia. And he did start on that trajectory. And but a year into his graduate studies, after a bad academic year, he was sort of forced to drop out of graduate school. And so dejected, you know, and disappointed, he somehow found his way into care work. And so Nelson's experience is sort of illustrative of that group of young adults who sort of entered care work because of these life interruptions. Some of the women, for example, had their educations interrupted, right, for certain reasons, and so became, you know, pregnancy-related reasons, for example. And so then they entered into care work as a result of these life interruptions. So they were sort of headed somewhere else and then sort of, you know, segued into care. Now, then the third group was the group who had migrated as working-aged adults. Oftentimes, they had started their careers in their home countries. They were established professionals, engineers, lawyers, teachers. And then when they entered the United States, they found that their credentials from their home countries, right, were not accepted in the U.S. labor market. And this is sort of quite common for immigrants in general. And so given that, right, given that they could not transfer their previous educational credentials and work experiences from their home countries, they then entered care work. And these groups of almost always entered at the lower tiers of the hierarchy or the entry level positions in support occupations as home care attendants or nursing attendants in nursing homes. And so this was the entry point into the labor market for these working adults. But all these three groups had the commonality of entering the labor market in there as adults, and oftentimes starting from someplace else.
Huh. I think to me, that was one of the things I found most interesting was the point you raised right at the beginning that none of the people you spoke to planned to go into this industry when they came to the United States. And so it made the fact that obviously they ended up there fascinating. Can you perhaps speak to another aspect that we've maybe touched on a little bit that brought people into it, African immigrant networks in bringing people into this work?
Absolutely. And these networks were central to locating folks into the labor market as care workers. First of all, just outside of care work, networks were just a helpful facilitating agent into life in America. So a majority of the participants had lived with a family member or a friend when they just arrived. So these networks were just really instrumental across the board. And this is not isolated to Africans, right? The immigration literature in the US and elsewhere is replete with evidence of how immigrant social networks across the board have been useful in helping other immigrants settle into life. This literature has shown how these networks help facilitate entry in the labor market writ large. This was certainly the case of the African immigrants I interviewed. And the African immigrant social networks were active in three ways, right? The first was that they helped sponsor the migration of others and helped settle them into life, including providing them with places to stay, as I have mentioned. The second was that they informed these newly arrived immigrants about care work. And newcomers, and this is what I actually found quite fascinating, was that the newcomers did not oftentimes know about the job. Many of these immigrants were coming from settings where the care for older adults, for example, was really a family affair. They were not even quite familiar with institutions like nursing homes, right, or even the industry of elder care. So it was the already settled immigrants from their home countries, their co-ethnics, who helped to introduce them into the work and to just give them this education, really, into this industry. And I tell this example in the book of one immigrant who came, this woman from Cameroon, and literally a week into her stay in the U.S., a family member says, "Oh, I'm going to get you a job as a DSP." And that's the acronym for direct support professional, right? This sort of career in disability support. And so this person had never heard of such a thing. And she said, you know, "What's a DSP?" And the family member says, "Just wait and you will find out." And so takes her to this care job that was sort of this informally brokered job. And this immigrant from Cameroon was explaining to me the fact that it was while she was on the job and actually performing the task of care for this care recipient that it occurred to her that, oh, you know, I've heard about Africans doing this work. So now that's what I'm doing. So really, it was quite like that, where newcomers, the folks I call in the book care pioneers, they were the ones who sort of really educated their fellow immigrants about the work. And then other immigrants talked about being influenced by seeing the folks who, older arrivals, those more settled immigrants who had made lives for themselves in care, especially the ones who had entered the nursing profession. And so these newcomers sort of were influenced by seeing the success of these more established immigrants. So again, these networks were very instrumental in either sort of telling people about the job and educating them about the job, of modeling an image of success that then others could seek and literally see as something that they could do in the U.S. And then finally, the third role of these networks was that they were instrumental in finding jobs, in actually locating newly arrived folks into the labor market. And they did this informally, like in the case of the Cameroonian woman I talked about previously. So where someone who would make, will sort of secure a job for a fellow immigrant in kind of these informal ways, but also formally, as these West Africans in the area that I studied had made inroads into the labor market as entrepreneurs. So some folks had actually opened up health provision businesses or labor brokering in agencies where they hired mostly other West African immigrants, and they brokered their services as home care workers and home home health workers. And so this final aspect of the social network was placing folks in the labor market, both formally and informally.
As you said, right, these networks are clearly quite crucial. And also there's a lot of adjustment. I mean, the idea of not even really knowing what the job is before one starts it is quite extreme. But even if you do know, what it's like day to day is obviously quite an adjustment as well. What role did social class play in how people adjusted to entering care work in the United States? And how did it make them think about, if we go right back to what we started with, the idea that deciding to go to the US is not a sort of, you know, there's a decision that goes into it with a lot of different factors being weighed up. How did the experience of adjusting to this work kind of influence how people thought about the decisions they'd made?
Actually, a lot of the sort of establishing work that deals with care and care work, the labor of care, is focused on gender, right? And sort of gender relations or the devaluing of the labor because it's associated with women's work and that kind of thing. And so gender is sort of well established as this sort of axis through which or lens through which one understands the work of care. Now, class, social class was also very salient in addition to gender and in addition to race, ethnicity, etc., was very salient for these workers. And, you know, class status in some ways was a common thread that was woven through their narratives. So the folks that I recruited and studied for this work were mostly middle class and professional from their home countries. So they almost always had migrated from the capital cities of their home countries or major cities. So they were urbanites, cosmopolitan in a lot of ways. They had formal education. Those who migrated as adults had bachelor's degrees and often higher. And they came from sort of middle class backgrounds, or they had achieved professional status prior to migrating. So in entering care work, they almost always entered through the entry level direct care jobs that involved sort of the direct and personal task of care. And they often found this to be very, very difficult. This was sort of manual labor, and oftentimes this was a class of folks who had actually hired domestic workers in their home countries. So the labor was very unfamiliar, and they struggled with the task that they had to perform. So there was a lot of sort of downward social mobility that was associated with their entry into care jobs, especially because they were starting out of the bottom of care hierarchies. They struggled with sort of the class inconsistency because they were caring mostly for people in the United States who were, in terms of race and class, would be sort of marginalized. And so they struggled with that, the fact that they felt that they came from sort of higher social strata, and they were sort of diminished in performing care for people who were marginalized. And they found aspects of the job degrading, right? The personal care, the bathing, etc. But they also simultaneously earned more money than they did at home. Right. So resulting in what other scholars have identified, right, status paradox in the word of Boris Nielsen, or contradictory class mobility, as Gasel Parenas talks about in her work on Filipino nurses, Filipino domestic workers, excuse me. So there was this the class inconsistency, status paradox, contradictory class mobility. And in the book, I sort of talk about this concept I call class ambivalence, sort of to capture that, the contradictory class location, you know, the fact that they were middle class and then sort of downgraded because of the task that they did, but also they gained in terms of their financial situation. A number then could earn money that not only subsidized them in the United States, but sort of helped them with their transnational commitments back home. And then the sort of psychological states of ambivalence that I uncovered and that I capture in Class Ambivalence was this, I was trying to get at their positioning sort of in between, right? As privileged economically, the working in the United States augmented their class status back home because they could send remittances, they could become the gift givers in their family, but at the same time, they were diminished by the work. And for the ones who worked in disability support, in that aspect of segment of the industry, they often worked in businesses that were owned by other West Africans. So within those ethnic-owned businesses, they felt, you know, that they had room for mobility within these businesses. A number of them had actually moved on to supervisory roles. And so, but at the same time, they were sort of located in this industry that was, they were sort of at the bottom of all of the hierarchies in the health industry. So again, this sort of in-between ambivalence, middle sort of straddling, right, these worlds where on the one hand there's downward mobility, but on the other hand there's opportunities for mobility and financial, you know, and financial gain.
Wow. It's in fact that second half I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about. You just mentioned the becoming supervisors, but also West African owned businesses and entrepreneurs. Can you tell us a bit more about how these were established and the role this played in sort of maintaining the fact that so many West African immigrants would come into the healthcare sector?
Yeah, great. And thanks for that question, because quite honestly, the entrepreneurship piece is one of the most fascinating aspects of this research. And just sort of from a personal note, it was quite satisfying and gratifying to uncover this dual role that they played as both workers, but also as business owners and labor brokers in the health industry. You know, other scholarship in care has sort of shown the presence of other immigrant groups in this niche. So there's a somewhat large literature on Filipino or Indian nurses, Caribbean nurses, and other care workers. But the focus has often been on their role as workers, right? And when the attention has been drawn to entrepreneurship, we have sort of imagined the actions of transnational recruitment agencies. So these sort of businesses operating at a transnational level and who act as mediators between the institutions, mostly hospitals in the global north, and who need workers and the laborers in the global south, right? So there's somewhat of a large literature on this sort of international brokering and international migration of health professionals. Now, here I found that West Africans in the area where I conducted the study were opening up businesses within that local economy, and they were hiring largely other West African workers. And the reason for that, I think, has to do with the particularity of the U.S. healthcare provision and funding infrastructure. The U.S. healthcare system has been described by others as a fragmented system with a mix of public, private, and hybrid providers or actors in care. The federal and state governments are active in funding healthcare, but there's also private interests and private businesses, such as private insurance companies, in the markets for care. The U.S. is also probably unique in that while the government provides funding streams for healthcare, Medicare is the state-subsidized health insurance plan for those 65 and over, and Medicaid is for those who meet certain poverty thresholds, right? So these are sort of federal and state-funded programs. So while the state provides the funds, it also leases the actual provision or the work of care, or the actual provision of these services to private contractors or players. So which makes way for private businesses to provide this care while capitalizing on government funding. So there's emerged what, observers of this have called a two-tier system of care, where private insurance companies and big business, big corporate interests are active in providing services to the rich, affluent, and professional and middle classes, and other actors who cater to a lower segment of the market, under-resourced and underserved segments. And so the folks I studied had entered the market at sort of this lower tier of provision. They had opened up small-scale businesses for the most part, and they relied mostly on government streams of income through Medicaid and Medicare to provide the services. But there was this one business in particular that I focused on in one of the chapters that they were fascinating, right? The business had been started by the first generation immigrant mother, though it was a family business. So the founder of the business had migrated from Sierra Leone in the late 60s and had sort of started a career in special education. So, but in the 90s, right, so sort of almost 30 years after living in the U.S., she was given a contract, a government contract to provide care for people with disabilities in home settings. And there was also at this time this move starting in the 60s and beyond to deinstitutionalize the care for certain segments of the population. So people with mental health problems and sort of intellectual disabilities and certain kinds of physical disabilities. And so this sort of pioneer in the industry, a woman I call Mrs. Johnson in the book, was a beneficiary of that. And she started the business, she was providing care in one home that she had rented. And at the time I conducted the study, this business had grown. It was sort of a major player in the disability support industry. The adult children, the second generation children, right, of the pioneer and her husband were all working in this business. They called it the family business, right? So this sort of family business in health provision. And they hired hundreds of mostly Sierra Leonean immigrants, and they cared for hundreds of care recipients who were mostly African American. And at the time of my research, they managed around 20 residential care homes. So theirs was a really fascinating story that I enjoyed. I enjoyed meeting them, and I enjoyed telling the story in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely fascinating. I'm sure you must have enjoyed having those conversations with them. But turning to another part of the book, I'd like to talk about African nurses, particularly you discuss in hospital, because in many ways, to me, this linked kind of the most closely to a lot of the existing literature you referenced earlier about kind of gender and nursing, right? Mm-hmm. But you talk about race and ethnicity being really big parts of African nurses' experiences in hospital and kind of ways of crafting professional work identities. Can you speak to this part of the book?
Sure, absolutely. And one thing was that surprised me, I think, was how much and how quickly race came up in the conversations, especially with the group who had become professional nurses and had entered the sort of the professional tiers of the industry. And they were working in mainstream institutions, largely in hospitals, but also in nursing homes. And they talked about race, their racial identities. And more sort of interestingly, they could name racism, they're using the term, right? Except one person who said black or white problems. But, you know, I was sort of surprised at how much race and their understandings of racism were salient in their narratives. And so race just worked in their experiences, and the theme of race sort of wove its way throughout their narratives. And so there was a clear sense that their location as Black people in America shaped their interactions. And so a recurring theme, right, was people, they as research subjects feeling unwelcome because of their race. A story that was repeated by a few people would be a story of how they would enter into the room and then a care receiver would just sort of view them and say they want another nurse. And so they interpreted this as it was a racial issue, right? They saw me, they didn't want to be cared for by a Black person. And so this sense of rejection because of race was salient. And there were also other themes of supervisors they felt belittling them, or family members sort of automatically ascribing them lower positions in the hierarchy. So there were these stories of family members who would relate to them as if they were sort of paraprofessional workers and not nurses. A frequent story was that family members will automatically turn to a white nursing aide and sort of assume that that nursing aide was the nurse. And so they saw that as, you know, this understanding that their location as people of color in the United States was sort of just automatically associated with being lesser qualified. And other researchers found this, other folks who are writing on nursing, for example, Adia Harvey Wingfield, who writes about African-Americans. Professionals, African-American professionals in the health industry has also found similar themes. But in addition to their racial location as Black people, these folks also talked about their ethnic identities in ways that were quite poignant. They sort of talked about their sense as African people and African-derived people, and that opened them up to an additional dimension of racial or racist animus. And I sort of think about that and sort of conceptualize this position that I term African origin discrimination, which is this also as sort of additional layer of racist animus, which is associated with being from Africa. And so my research interlocutors believed that their patients and patients' family members and their colleagues and supervisors sort of associated being African as lacking cultural capital or not sort of knowing what, not just not being informed and educated. And so they sort of spoke a lot about, you know, being African as this status that opened them up to further marginalization. And so in thinking about African origin discrimination, I am drawing from the experiences of my research subjects, but I'm also building and connecting with other research that has found this in the United States, in Canada, and in Europe, where people with recent histories from Africa experience a certain kind of racism that is associated with the loss of what one scholar calls the loss of linguistic capital. So even though they speak English and oftentimes speak English very well, they perceive that because of their African accents or their African forms of spoken English, that the co-workers and colleagues sort of do not respond very well to them. So the erasure of linguistic capital. In my case, I found that also. I also found that, you know, folks felt that people had negative stereotypes about Africa as a continent. They often had sort of just this misunderstandings of the continent. And really negative, stereotypic views about Africa. And the folks I interacted with felt that this negatively affected them in work settings.
Huh. So given these multiple different factors that are impacting people in work settings, the different ways in which people come in, the different experiences and adjustments they have, what did success mean for the people you spoke to? And to what extent do their like real world actual ideas of success fit into sort of the more mythic narratives we often hear about the kind of quote unquote American dream?
Yeah. And so just like their motivations and pathways were nuanced, so too is this question of success, right? So success meant very different things, I think, for the different the various groups of workers I interviewed, and even, you know, there's various groups. So one easy way that to say to measure success will be the extent to which they felt they had fully integrated into their work life. And by that, I mean that oftentimes the folks had pined away for their old job. So even while they were in care work, they felt that, okay, you know, maybe I'll do this for a few years and then I would get back to becoming, you know, an economist or whatever they were doing. And but as they encountered the obstacles in the U.S. society, those dreams, you know, became of doing something else or maybe of pursuing former careers. You know, over time, those dreams diminished. But and they oftentimes felt very disappointed by that. But over time, and as they spent more time in the care industry, many articulated this transformation. And this was most salient for the disability support professionals who just spoke about their gains in these sort of spiritual terms that they felt they had become better people. They had learned a better sense of humanity, especially because they worked with folks who had severe cognitive, physical, intellectual disabilities. They felt and I sort of articulated these ideas of becoming better people. And they, over time, those old career dreams sort of flew away. As one person said, you know, if you ask me about do I want to make money, of course, you know, everybody wants to make money. I want to do something where I'll make more money than I do now. But to be honest with you, they said to me, I would rather keep doing this work because I feel such a sense of fulfillment. So there was a lot of intrinsic rewards for the folks, especially the folks who were disability professionals, that could be regarded, right, as and counted as success. And that's definitely how these folks felt. They felt they had gained a lot. And they had gained in intrinsic rewards and intangible rewards, but also in tangible ways. They felt that they had expertise. They felt that they had, you know, new ideas about disability and managing and orientations towards disability that they thought they could encourage their governments, for instance, back home, right, to sort of change the orientation to disability support. Now, another way to that success could be measured was sort of in material terms, in extrinsic ways. And the folks had made gains there too, especially the ones who were professional nurses, right? In material terms, they had been able to buy nice homes. I often did these interviews in their homes, you know, and I was quite honestly impressed, right, with sort of the material possessions, the home, sometimes luxury cars in the driveway. They had done well in terms of financial support and financial achievement, right? But again, this is contradictory in some ways because the reason why they had become financially secure was because they worked often in long hours and overwork, so to earn overwork hours and those kinds of things. So again, there was material success, but this came at a price. It came at, it took sort of corporeal toll on their bodies, right, and physical health. And of course, as we discussed earlier, they worked in these, for the nurses, they worked in these segments that were very stressful. They felt the stress of racism and feeling unwelcome in these settings. So, and you asked about the American dream, right? Quote unquote, the American dream. And usually, you know, scholars of immigration in the US have sort of used this heuristic device of the American dream to sort of test migration projects, right? But for I would be a little bit more critical for this group, right? First of all, what is the American dream and what does it mean for this group of workers? I would say they had made a lot of gains in the ways that I've mentioned. And this is sort of contrary to some other portrayals of care workers, right? Where the focus has been on exploitation and servitude and certainly there was some of that. Many of these of the people I met had been able to make inroads, as I have shown in the book and as we've hinted here. They had become successful, they had had upward mobility, but these came at sort of tremendous cost. Some gains, but also overwhelming costs.
Yeah, definitely complicates the generalized assumption. What do you think are some of the policy or practical implications of what you've come up with in this research?
Yeah, great. And I think I'll sort of limit my comments here to just a couple of things, I think. I think there are implications for the sending countries in West Africa. There's been quite some talk about the so-called brain drain of professionals in these countries, generally in countries of the Global South, and especially in the health industry. So there's been attention has been paid to the health professionals who migrate, leaving health care systems that need them, you know, overstretched and under-resourced healthcare. And, you know, it has been posed as a sort of ethical issue for the recruiting countries in the Global North and then the toll for the countries of the Global South. Here, the findings of this research suggest something else. A group of folks who are not really captured in that brain drain narrative. Yes, certainly they were professionals who left their home countries. Oftentimes they could not directly translate their skills in the labor market, resulting in so-called brain waste. But the story doesn't end there. These folks actually were able to become re-credentialed in the health industry. And they've you know, being able to make and create a niche market in the United States in a segment of the labor market that really needs their labor. And I think there's potential for the sending countries of West Africa to harness the capital, the human capital, the social capital of this group. Many, right, have done well, even beyond the folks that have, whose lives I've chronicled in this book, in the West African immigrant communities, right, credentialed people in healthcare, whom the governments could do well to tap into, their expertise in terms of assisting the health systems there, in terms of capacity building. And I found that the folks were very eager to give back to their home countries. So the sending countries could do well, I believe, to, you know, tap into the capital here. And for the receiving country, in this case, the United States, this study has shown a pathway that isn't, I don't think, much talked about or understood, which is folks situated within a receiving country who are able to enter a place where there's a structural need for their labor and to make inroads within the various hierarchies of this industry. In health care, the folks entered at the bottom of the industry, but were able to gain credentials, oftentimes in stepwise way. They worked and they earned money and saved money and put aside money. And see, for really, you know, investing the resources in themselves to make their way in this industry where their needs, where there's a need for their labor. And I think that these kinds of opportunities could be opened up to more people with more support and more resources, even beyond immigrant communities, the native-born populations in the United States, who could be incentivized to you know, in programs like providing career ladders where people could work from one segment to the other. In the post-COVID world, right, this may be actually very important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Incredibly relevant, as we've mentioned really throughout the interview. So I only have one question left, really. Now that this book is done and out in the world, is there anything you might be working on now, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on this exact topic, that you'd like to preview or highlight?
Yeah, absolutely. So no rest for the weary. I'm actually working on a couple of projects. One stems sort of maybe directly from this project. As I mentioned in the beginning, as it was sort of clear in our discussion, the people in this study in Migrants Who Care became health professionals while in the United States. So I've sort of become interested in the health professionals in training in the sending countries. You know, I started thinking about, but what does it mean to study in the health professions in the countries from which my current immigrants derive, and what are the young trainees there thinking about their own trajectories and futures? And so my newest work is beginning to think about medical trainees in Ghana. I've become much more interested now in the medical profession. So configuring an ethnography on Ghanaian medical students. I'm interested more broadly in the training of lay people, the transformation of lay persons into medical professionals. And so the project is broadly on medicals training, how people are trained in biomedicine in a non-Western context. But part of that will also uncover how these folks in an immigrant sending country, young people coming of age in an immigrant sending country are thinking about their futures. And I want to think about whether any part of their trajectories involve moving to migrating elsewhere. And so that's the project, medical training in Ghana, West Africa, and migration aspirations among that group.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for giving us a preview of that next project. I have to say, I hope it becomes a book, because then we can have you back and you can tell us more about it. But of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, titled Migrants Who Care, West Africans Working and Building Lives in U.S. Healthcare, published by Rutgers University Press. Fumilayo, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It was an absolute pleasure.